Hello and welcome to the History of England. This is a supplementary episode because we got some questions in from a couple of people and I just happen to have my brother here.
Hi David.
Hello Jonathan. My brother lives in California, so since he was over we thought we'd do a bit of podcasting together. Tastes all a bit weird, but it's fine.
Yep.
So Jonathan, Ellen wrote in with a question. What does she write?
Ellen writes, I'm curious about the balance between ecclesiastic and secular law during the different periods. For example, I vaguely remember reading somewhere that marriage was a civil union only in a lot of Christian Europe, until much later than I had imagined. Is this actually the case?
So, Ellen, I thought this was really, it was very nice to get a question, because you'll remember last time when I first put it out there to say everybody put a question in, nobody did. So it was really nice to get some questions. I thought this was a really interesting one. So I went back and had a look at it. And what I found out was that in Anglo-Saxon England, actually all law went through the Hundred Court. So through the Hundred Court and through the Shire Reeve. But then when the Normans arrived, and in 1072, one of the things that Billy the Conk did is that he ordained that a church should have its own courts and its own canon law, separate from the secular Hundred Courts. And that would be run by the bishop or the archdeacon. We don't know exactly at this stage what constituted an ecclesiastical or secular case, but here, for the first time, is some separation between the two. So that's interesting. I hadn't realised that it was the Normans that started it. The sorts of things that they do in an ecclesiastical court were things like getting fines from people who breached the rules of Christianity. So adulterers, sorcerers, that kind of thing.
So does that mean that if you're an adulterer, you wouldn't go to civil court, or it only goes to
yeah,
church
I
court?
Think that's probably right, actually. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah, I think that's probably right. That would have been a crime against Christianity in this case, I suppose, or church law. All cases arising from matrimony, and we'll come on to that in a bit as well. And anything, so a cleric would always go through the court of the church, the ecclesiastical courts, rather than the secular ones. And actually that becomes a matter of some argument.
Okay, so even if he murdered somebody?
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, no, hang on. If it's murder...
That's a bit too much.
Absolutely. Okay. So murder is one of the things that gets reserved to royal justice.
If he stole something, then he'd stay within the church system.
Absolutely. So if it was kind of lesser crimes, he would go through the church courts. One another thing to note is that the king is still the ultimate boss. All these powers come from the king, not the pope, which is interesting. I mean, one of the things you see from this is one of the features of medieval times is all these different laws. So now we've got royal law, we've got canon law, we've got feudal law, and pretty soon we'll have English common law as well. So all these different laws running at the same time. Anyway, that was very good. So the second question you asked, Ellen, was about marriage. And yes, you're absolutely right. In Anglo-Saxon times, marriage was an entirely a civil matter, not a church matter. You didn't get married in church or anything like that. Then in the 11th century, or somewhere around the 11th or 12th century, two things happen.
Okay, what were those?
So number one was that the secular courts gave up any rights to do with marriage and matrimony and handed across to the ecclesiastical courts, so it becomes an entirely church matter. And the second was the church decided exactly what a legal marriage meant.
And what would that be?
Glad you asked that, Jonathan.
Okay.
The central point was the free consent of both parties. So the free consent thing was finally confirmed by a chap called Pope Alexander III in the mid-12th century. And for a marriage to be absolutely valid, it just had to be that both people had to say, I take you as my husband, I take you as my wife, you know, depending on the sex. And then follow it up with a good bit of consummation.
Jolly good.
Jolly good. And if it wasn't consummated, the consummation didn't have to be good, it just had to happen, in fact.
Yeah.
The other thing was that they defined that there could be no marriage before the age of...
I'm guessing 11?
Seven. So if you got married at 8, that was all legal above board. If you got married before 7, bit dodgy. Anyway, unusually, I think a round of applause to the church then, because this thing about marriage just involving the consent of both parties was actually pretty radical in terms of family politics. In feudal law, for example, the lord had a right to agree to the marriage of any member of his vassal's family. It was seen as one of your key rights, because marriage was obviously an important thing about making alliances, getting lands, getting dowers, and all the rest of it. So this is actually pretty radical. And they moan about it, and there's a lot of social pressure that actually means that a lot of people get married even though they haven't consented because their dad says, look, you're marrying John down the road because he's got vast tracts of land, all right? Okay, you're marrying him. I don't care what you say, you're marrying him. And mostly they give away. But then, in 1200, the church says, okay, so lots of complaints about that, and they're worried about, you know, parents are worried about children running away and getting married without, you know, marrying some ne'er-do-well. So in 1200, the church decided that in order to be legal now, marriages, you also had to read banns, okay? Mm-hmm. And that kind of meant that it was publicly announced to everybody, and so, you know, the parents could take the appropriate action. A couple of other little things about marriage. I realise I am aware that I'm now rambling, but a couple of other things because it was just interesting, Alan, when I had a look at all this. So marriage, the wedding took place at the church door. It didn't actually go in. You went into mass afterwards, but the actual ceremony itself was happened at the church door. The man was expected to give the wife her dower at the church door. So what they normally did was they'd give a sort of gift as a symbol. So that might be a ring, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay. The historian I read actually said it might be a gift like a knife. I have to say, I thought was somehow less appropriate. But, yes. You know, knife, if that's your thing. Anyway, all jolly interesting. Good. So, Jonathan, Ellen asked another question.
Ellen asks, I'm also curious about how trade worked in these times. You've mentioned that parts of what made London so successful was trade. But I'm curious, who was doing the trading? It doesn't fit comfortably with feudalism, so was there a small merchant class?
Yes, because feudalism was all about everybody knowing their place. Basically, if you were a villain or a villager, you had to stay where you were. And I found a couple of court cases in Cornwall where there's a chap called, where a lord puts Ralph, the villain, in chains, and he says, look, I put him in chains, quite legally so, because he wanted to leave. And that was kind of okay.
So where does this word villein come from?
Villein, actually, since you mentioned it, comes from, I think it's just simply a word for villager.
Okay.
So although it's become associated with villain and evil men doing, in Doomsday it was simply description of villager.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then there's another court case where the lord actually, this is completely irrelevant by the way, Ellen, to your question, and indeed Jonathan to Ellen's question. There's another one where the lord sells the villain's sister for 4 shillings. Sorry, I've sold your sister. I mean, that's not great. So nipping off to the towns, my point is, Ellen, you're absolutely right, it's not easy. How do you become a merchant? How do you get away from those feudal laws? And certainly merchants were oddities. They didn't have any high status in our period. You know, they were thought as odd and outside the normal life. They actually needed royal protection. There were laws laid down about what you can and can't do. And they had to struggle against a whole load of obstacles, you know. Going from A to B meant that you went through different laws and just different jurisdictions with people and different people in control. There would be tolls every time you walked onto a different lord's lands, which you had to pay. And they got taxed. Taxed to death by barons and princes would be an easy way of getting hold of money. So in actual fact, merchants were probably viewed with only slightly less suspicion than were the Jews who had just arrived at this point. So merchants in towns were pretty much ghettos, you know, they were seas in a flood of normal feudal life. So yes, there were, Alan, specific people as merchants, and yes, they had to be pretty different kind of people to make it work. Okay, so that was very good. Then we also got a question from somebody called Pete S. Now we suspect Pete may be not unconnected with my brother, but we don't know. So anyway, Jonathan.
Okay. Sorry. Pete said, listening to the podcast, I had this question. What languages were prevalent? Old English, I assume, but there must have been bits of French, maybe still Latin, some Scandinavian languages here and there.
I love this question, actually, Pete, because I think the story of the development of English is absolutely fascinating. I am by no means an expert. Well, I'm not an expert at anything, actually, since you mentioned it, but I'm not an expert in linguistics. But some linguists once told me there are over 400 dialects in the UK.
Yep.
So there you go. So, after the arrival of the Normans, there were two types of vernacular languages, basically. There was French and English. And then there was one other language in operation, which
Latin.
Was, of course, Latin. Correct. English was the mother tongue for most inhabitants at the time. The vast majority of people used English as their mother tongue. Latin was the language of the church and was used as an official documents language. So, in actual fact, we've got this very odd situation where nobody apart from clerics could read. Nobody except for clerics could speak Latin. So you've got all this communication from government about charters and writs, which nobody could read apart from, you know, a lord would get a charter and you've absolutely no idea what it said. But anyway, there you go.
And that was presumably deliberate by the church.
Well, maybe it was. Well, yes. absolutely. It gave the church loads of power and control. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. So then the Old English, one of the mother tongues, would have been riddled with dialects coming from the various backgrounds of the inhabitants of England, from Norway, from Denmark, from Frisia. Being Germanic languages, they would have had trouble in communicating, but they would have been able to basically understand each other with difficulty. And one of the, actually, I found this quote by a chap called William of Malmesbury, who's a chronicler in the 12th century, and he says, "The whole language of the Northumbrians, especially in York, is so grating and uncouth that we Southerners cannot understand a word of it." So the North-South divide started in the 12th century. And there's a court case around 1200 where everything rests on the fact that both parties come from different parts of England and they both have different words for egg. And therefore they get very grumpy because they can't understand each other. And lots of confusion. So essentially, think of today's situation times 100. One language, but dialects that were, you know, way more different than we've got now.
Right.
So French became the language of the nobility and the official language of court. It was the language that had prestige and social status and so on. And in fact, the period we're talking about is really bad for English literature because, you know, who would write in that grubby old English, you know, if you had... if you wanted to write something flowery literature, you'd use French. Something official, you'd use, you know, Latin. Actually, I think what's quite surprising is that French lasts as long as it does. You know, I've always thought, good old English, you know, it survived the Norman invasion and, you know, because it's such a great language, it before too long it becomes the dominant language again and French gets subsumed into it. And but in actual fact, French survives as the official language of England for a good 300 years after the conquest. And actually that's surprising because you'd have thought it would disappear within a couple of generations because there weren't very many Normans. The vast majority of the population was English and English-speaking, and the Normans very quickly intermarried into the English. So actually, it's surprising that French lasted as long as it did as the official language.
Right.
I think the reason that it does survive so long is that you had all these English dialects. So in order to communicate effectively, and to know that you could communicate effectively with everybody in the country, if you learnt French, you knew you were going to be able to communicate with most people who mattered.
So French was basically the same throughout the country, but
yes,
English wasn't.
Absolutely. French didn't have all these dialects, that's exactly right. So if you learned French, you weren't going to be able to speak to everybody, because there'd be lots of, you know, villeins and all the rest of it who wouldn't speak any French. But all the people in power, all the people with control and in authority, they would speak French.
Right.
So wherever you went, you'd be able to make yourself understood.
Okay.
Very good. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for your questions and keep them coming. And Jonathan, thank you for joining me with my podcast.
It's been great here.
It's been great, hasn't it?
And I'll head back to California.
Yes.
Where it's a little bit warmer.
Where it's a little bit warmer and it won't be raining. Very good. Okay. Thanks everybody. Bye-bye.